from deep inside your radio. Mother
of mine. Any man who loves his mother is man enough for me. Brightening her hours, sending her flowers, though it's no anniversary. Many men want fame and fortune, it's gold they love to see. But I'd say a man who loves his mother is man enough for me.
Mother of mine.
Many men love dogs and kittens and pet them constantly. But show me a man who loves his mother.
His mother.
As much as she wants to be. And I'll show you a man who is man enough for me.
Mother of mine.
Okay, we got that out of the way. Now, ladies and gentlemen, from Santa Monica, this is Santa Monica, California, and this is a story about Santa Monica, California. A city, now, eat your hearts out. Localities, municipalities around the country who have to fire teachers or police people, fire people because you don't have enough funds. Here, according to at least one published estimate, Santa Monica is building a park and spending $47 million on it. That has got to be some great grass. Some nutty, nutty trees. $47 million. But you can't just build a park when you're Santa Monica. You have to make sure that everything around it is appropriate. On the edge of the park is a small, well, you'd have to call it a beach shack, because this is a beach city. A beach shack that's been there for 50 years and has been for that length of time, and may have been there before it had an existence as a restaurant, but it's been a restaurant for about 50 years. And it's just, you know, it's a beach shack steak joint like beach cities would have, you see. Been kind of well-loved by some folks. I patronized it in the days when I ate steak out. Not a stakeout, Sergeant Friday, just, you know. Anyway, before the eponymous owner of the restaurant died, he got a promise from the city of Santa Monica that they would maintain the restaurant, that they wouldn't mess with the restaurant. It's on city-owned land, but he was leasing it. So he got that promise from the city of Santa Monica. Well, now they're spending $47 million on a park, and they want the restaurant adjoining the park to be, you know, more appropriate. A beach shack steak joint isn't an appropriate companion to a $47 million park, so they've issued a request for people to bid on the property. The current management, of course, can bid if they want to totally redo the place. And the city manager has said of the promise, now that the guy is dead that they gave the promise to, oh, we're not allowed to give promises like that. So, at least for a while, ladies and gentlemen, no longer the home of the homeless, home of the rubber promise. Hello, welcome to the show.
Say up. prayers to the man upstairs. And in the meantime, let's just swing. I don't mean to fiddle while Ron Burns, no. I just mean we'll get your small concerns. Oh, let's swing.
Let's swing.
Let's swing.
Let's swing.
Let's swing, swing, swing. Let's swing.
Let's swing.
Let's swing.
Let's swing. Who knows what tomorrow may bring.
From the edge of America, from the home of the Rubber Promise, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, we are not number one. This is from the Brookings Institution. Many Americans believe that students in the United States ranked number one in the world on international tests several decades ago, and that after years of bad policies fell to the bottom of the pack. This is a myth. The United States never led the world. It was never number one and has never been close to number one on international math tests or on science tests. It is more accurate to say that the United States has always trailed the world on math tests, and there has been no sharp decline in either the short or long run. The United States performance on a particular math test has been flat to slightly up since the test's inception, but we've never been number one. Hope that settles that. Ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. The Vatican is investigating seven priests from the troubled Legion of Christ religious order for alleged sexual abuse of minors. It's a legion of abusers. It's evidence that the scandal over the order's pedophile founder doesn't rest solely with him. This from the AP. Two other Legion priests are being investigated by the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith for alleged sacramental violations believed to involve abusing spiritual direction and other pastoral care to have inappropriate sexual relations with women. That would be the bottom line of that phraseology. The investigations mark the first known Vatican action against Legion priests following the revelations that the Legion's founder, who was long held up as a model by the Vatican, despite credible allegations later proven that he was a drug addict who raped and molested his seminarians. The Legion is now under Vatican receivership, has insisted that the crimes of the Reverend Marcial Maciel were his alone. But the Vatican investigation of other Legion priests indicates that the same culture of secrecy that Maciel created within the order to cover his crimes enabled other priests to abuse children, just as abusive clergy of other religious orders and dioceses have done around the world. In a statement this week to the AP, the Legion confirmed it referred seven cases of alleged abuse to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the Vatican office that investigates sex crimes. Well named. That's how you know how to find it. If you needed to have a sex crime investigated, just look up Doctrine of the Faith. All but one involves alleged abuse dating from decades ago. One case involves recent events. The Legion issued its statement to the AP after the news organization approached it with the allegations. The Legion simultaneously sent the statement out to all priests in the order. While the priests in question are under investigation, their access to children has been restricted, the Legion said. Never too late. So, when you hear about Legionnaire's disease, make sure you know what kind. Dateline Philadelphia, that trial keeps spewing forth some interesting news of the godly. Roman Catholic parishioners were told the priest had to leave his church in 1992 because he had Lyme disease, even though his removal actually came after an altar boy's fondling complaint. That's what a witness testified this week. Mary Mignogno, who knew about the boy's complaint, didn't know what to say to her children when she heard the lie from the pulpit. She's a nurse and school volunteer. She'd helped the boy tell his parents about the abuse. And from Ireland, there's more to Ireland than this, but there is this, a new reference book on the Archdiocese of Dublin, which lists every priest who served there up to 2011, leaves out some important names. The 400-page book, The Archbishops, Bishops, and Priests Who Served in the Archdiocese of Dublin 1900 to 2011 gives the names and CVs of the nearly 2,000 priests who have served since that time, except those guilty of sex abuse, who have been airbrushed from the history. To date, the Dublin Archdiocese has paid out over $17.5 million in compensation to victims of abuse. Well over 500 victims have been identified, at least 8 priests have faced criminal cases, and civil actions have been brought against 35 priests, all of whom were part of the Archdiocese, although you can't tell by reading the book. And, of course, if you didn't see it in the New York Times this week, a story about sexual abuse among the ultra-Orthodox in Brooklyn and severe intimidation and retribution by rabbis and other community leaders to those who sought to take those complaints to the police rather than have them dealt with by the rabbis. News of the Godly, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now, news of the warm, won't you? Yes, I'm enthusiastic. Why wouldn't I be?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Well, actually, there are good reasons. The effects of global warming are making it more difficult for reservoir managers to control floods and manage flows for irrigation, recreation, and fisheries. This in Idaho. 2 days of record high temperatures and 2 days of record rainfall the same week in late April sent 26,000 cubic feet per second surging into the Boise River dam system, forcing federal river managers to increase flows. As late as the middle of January, this looked as if it was going to be a dry year. But then the snows finally came, and in March, much of the precipitation fell as rain. The April warm spell and rains are examples of the higher variability that experts say we can expect because of global warming. That's making it harder to predict how reservoirs will fill and what the flows will be in rivers with and without dams. Despite better modern equipment, says Patrick McGuire, manager of river operations for the Bureau of Reclamation's Pacific Northwest region, our forecasts were more accurate in the 60s and the 70s than they are now. The more variability there is in the climate, the harder it is for the two federal dam managing agencies, Bureau of Reclamation and the Army Corps of Engineers, to balance their competing tasks of preventing floods while filling the reservoirs to provide water for various uses. You'd think preventing floods would be a number one. You're not a water manager. A paper in Science magazine finds rapidly changing ocean salinities as a result of warming atmosphere have intensified the global water cycle by an incredible 4% between 1950 and 2000, twice the rate predicted by models. Look, if you're going to ask models, you know, they only get a chance to read while they're under the hairdryer. These same models have long forecast that dry areas of Earth will become drier and wet areas wetter in a warming climate, an intensification of the water cycle driven mostly by the capacity of warmer air to hold and redistribute more moisture in the form of water vapor. But the rate of intensification of the global water cycle is happening far faster than imagined, about 8% per degree Celsius of ocean warming since 1950. At that rate, the authors calculate the global water cycle will intensify by 16% in a 2 degrees Celsius warmer world and 24% in a 3 degree warmer world. Not uniform across the globe, increased drying of arid areas, increased flooding of wet areas. The resulting changes in freshwater availability are likely to be far more destabilizing to human societies and ecosystems than warming alone. Let's turn it over to the bonobos now, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get out of their way. Experiments may dramatically underestimate how plants will respond to climate change in the future. That's the conclusion of an analysis of 50 plant studies on four continents published by the journal Nature, which found that shifts in the timing of flowering and leafing in plants due to global warming appear to be much greater than estimated by warming experiments. Again, with the greater. This suggests that predicted ecosystem changes, including the continuing advances in the start of spring across much of the globe.
What could be wrong with an earlier spring? I love spring.
May be far greater than current estimates based on data from experiments, says Elizabeth Walkovich, an ecologist at the University of British Columbia, who led a team of scientists. These findings have extensive consequences for prediction of species diversity, ecosystem services, and global models of future change, said another author of the study. Predicting plant responses to climate change has important consequences for human water supply, pollination of crops, and the overall health of ecosystems. Studies in the timing of annual plant events, which biologists call phenology with a PH, are some of the most consistent and visible responses to climate change. And changes in the speed that ice travels in more than 200 outlet glaciers indicates that Greenland's contribution to rising sea level in this century might be significantly less than the upper limits some scientists thought possible. So we've got the greater, we got the lesser. This according to a new study. So far, on average, we're seeing about a 30% speed up in 10 years, says Twyla Moon, a University of Washington doctoral student and lead author of a paper published in Science. The faster the glaciers move, the more ice and meltwater they release into the ocean. In a previous study, scientists trying to understand the contribution of melting ice to rising sea level considered a scenario in which the Greenland glaciers would double their velocity and then stabilize at the higher speed, and another scenario in which the speeds would increase tenfold and then stabilize. In the new study, the scientists created a decade-long record of changes in Greenland glaciers. They found that the outlet glaciers had not increased in velocity as much as had been speculated. Despite the fact I can't pronounce the word glacier, news of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now news of Alpha. Yeah, I lost the audition. And I'm proud of it. First of all, this. Republican lawmakers gave cautious reactions this week to socialist François Hollande's presidential win in France, with one senator warning the result could mark an unnerving setback in Afghanistan. Since newly elected President Hollande has said he wants French troops out of Afghanistan by the end of this year. Unlike us, our president just said we're staying until he's got a worldwide foundation that makes as much money as Bill Clinton. Quote, if the result of the election is that the French are going to withdraw from Afghanistan by the end of the year, that's unnerving because we're well on our way to getting Afghanistan right, Senator Lindsey Graham told Agence France-Presse. He must not have been reading these. Two British servicemen have been shot dead in southern Afghanistan by members of the Afghan National Police Force. This according today to the British Ministry of Defense. They had been providing security near a base in the Lashkargah district of Helmand Province. You know that district. It's where all the cool stuff happens, Lashkargah. Their next of kin have been informed. The men were serving as part of an advisory team were killed yesterday as they provided security for a meeting with local officials. He believed one of the gunmen was then killed by his Afghan police colleagues, while the second escaped. Men were wearing Afghan police uniforms. The International Security Assistance Force, which is the coalition, refused to provide nationality or gender information on the dead soldiers. The attack is the latest, says McClatchy, in a series of so-called green-on-blue killings. That have seen Afghan soldiers or policemen turn their weapons on their coalition colleagues, Senator Graham. ISAF said it had recorded 15 green-on-blue attacks so far this year, which had resulted in 20 coalition deaths. There were 21 such attacks in all of last year, killing 35 coalition members. So, increasing. But we're this close to getting it right. And now, the apologies of the week. On a related subject, too.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Kabul. NATO and the U.S. military apologized this week to the families and loved ones of Afghans killed in coalition airstrikes this month in two villages. Quote, unfortunately, the preliminary investigations into these events have determined that our actions have resulted in a number of deaths and injuries to Afghan civilians, said a statement from NATO. The coalition takes full responsibility for these tragic and regrettable incidents. We'll meet with family members of those who died to express our sincere condolences. The deaths occurred earlier this month. Coalition said, President Karzai will be assured of our commitment to take any and all appropriate actions to minimize the likelihood of similar occurrences in the future. Karzai expressed dismay over the airstrikes, and his spokesman said they were unacceptable to the Afghan government. The head of the Irish Catholic Church apologized on Monday to victims of sexual abuse, but rejected calls to resign after a TV documentary reported he had failed to warn parents their children were being sexually abused by a priest way back in 1975. The documentary broadcast by Britain's BBC said child victim Brendan Boland gave Cardinal Sean Brady the names and addresses of children being abused by pedophile Brendan Smythe during a church investigation, but Brady failed to act to ensure their safety. I apologize without hesitation to him and to any victim, Brady told state broadcaster RTE. But I'm staying right here.
Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Because I'm so sorry. Deadline Toronto, a Muslim Sunday school has apologized for anti-Jewish teachings that appeared in its website under investigation as a possible hate crime by regional police. The East End Madrasa weekend religious program run by a mosque using space rented in a high school issued a press release to unreservedly apologize to the Jewish community for the unintentional offense the item has caused. Our curriculum is not intended to promote hatred towards any individual or group of people. Jewish groups had expressed shock at the curriculum on the madrasa's website that called ancient Jews treacherous and crafty and accused them of conspiring to kill the Prophet Muhammad. A Yahoo CEO Scott Thompson says he's sorry, but he's not admitting any wrongdoing. So it's, I guess, just a Yahoo boo. Thompson, under heavy fire for a discrepancy in his resume, sent an apology via email to company employees for the tumult that has embroiled Yahoo for nearly a week. He did not say he was stepping down and did not address the issue of his CV. Quote, as I told you, the board is reviewing the issue and I will provide whatever they need from me. In the meantime, I want you to know how deeply I regret how this issue has affected the company and all of you. For that, I take full responsibility and I want to apologize to you, he said. Yahoo's board has been looking into the issue. Demands for Thompson's ouster started after Yahoo disclosed its board is investigating the resume discrepancy. Both Thompson's CV and Yahoo's regulatory filings overstated his technology background to include a degree in computer science that he does not have. The company called it an inadvertent error. Yahoo's core business, in case you've forgotten, internet search engine. But they could have Googled it, too. Sacha Baron Cohen has apologized to Ryan Seacrest for the ash-spilling prank he pulled on the TV presenter at the Oscars in February. The funny man dressed as the title character from his new film to walk the red carpet at the Hollywood Awards show, and he tipped what he claimed were late North Korean leader Kim Jong-il's remains all over the American Idol host in a stunt to promote the movie. However, backstage at this weekend's Saturday Night Live show, Cohen made amends with Seacrest, and the actor's wife, Isla Fisher, also apologized for her husband's antics. Seacrest said, "I saw Isla Fisher, and I said hi, and she said these words, and then it dawned on me. She said, 'I apologize for my husband,' and I said, 'Oh, yeah, gotcha, thank you. Thank you very much for saying that.'" Sacha Baron Cohen comes off stage, comes over to me, breaks character, and says, "Sorry about the Oscars. It wasn't personal. He was very apologetic and genuine and kind and sweet." He also said, Cohen told Seacrest he wasn't the original target for the prank. Seacrest adds, he started telling me how it went down. Originally he said they were going to spill whatever it was in that urn on George Clooney. Someone decided that wasn't a great idea because he was up for a lot of nominations. I'm still laughing. Deadline Mexico City, Mexico's electoral authority apologized to voters this week after a sober presidential debate in Mexico, was upstaged by a former Playboy model and her revealing outfit, clad in a tight-fitting white dress with a cut below the neckline to show much of her cleavage. Julia Orayen was working, as an assistant on the televised debate. At the start, she walked in front of the camera to hand out cards to the four candidates and created an immediate stir on online social media. The appearance lasted a few seconds. It quickly began trending on Twitter, generating thousands of mentions, and the Mexican newspaper declared her the online winner of the debate. Three major UK publishers last week apologized and paid damages to an Algerian man they had accused of being a gangster and offering a safe house to terrorists, among other false claims. The publishers removed the offending pieces from their websites and published online notices about the apology and a recent court appearance. No, none of the publications were owned by Rupert Murdoch. I know. Me too. The funeral home director in Libertyville, Illinois, who misplaced Marjorie Jean Supanich's ashes for more than 2 years, not as a stunt to promote a movie, apologized to her relatives and refunded the fees they paid. "But that doesn't ease the pain and aggravation the five daughters suffered," said Wanda Supanich, one of the sisters. "Dad said everything is good now. The rest of us are really not satisfied." They may be pursuing legal action. Employees of the funeral home repeatedly told Wanda that her mother's ashes had not been returned from the Anatomical Gift Association of Illinois, where Marjorie Jean Supanich had donated her body. However, family members recently found they were left in a cabinet in the funeral home for more than 2 years. The same funeral home was in the spotlight in 2010 when the operator's daughter pleaded guilty to desecrating human remains. A leading Southern Baptist ethicist has issued a second apology for his remarks about the fatal shooting of the teenager in Florida. On Wednesday, Richard Land, president of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, said he was guilty of making injudicious comments about the shooting of Trayvon Martin during a radio broadcast. Land had defended the shooter, George Zimmerman, who he said had been treated unfairly in the media. Land apologized first to Martin's family in a statement. He had also accused President Obama of using the Martin shooting for political gain. During the broadcast, he labeled Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton as race hustlers. Then, on his now written statements, personal letters of apology to Obama, Jackson, and Sharpton, asking their forgiveness. "It was unchristian and unwise for me to have done so. God alone is the searcher of men's hearts." I don't envy him. Dateline Jerusalem, Israel's national airline, has apologized to President Shimon Peres after attempting to charge him nearly $5,000 to bring an oxygen tank on an official trip to Canada. Israeli officials said Peres wanted to put the matter behind him. I guess that's what politicians like to do. The British Columbia government apologized this week for its part in the internment of 22,000 Japanese Canadians during the Second World War. Who knew? Naomi Yamamoto, the Minister of Advanced Education, who knew, rose in the legislature and introduced a motion including the apology, which passed unanimously. Yamamoto's parents were among those interned. I swear, Canada imitates everything we do. The militant accused of building bombs for the 2002 Bali nightclub attacks that killed 202 people apologized this week for the first time to the victims and their families. Umar Patek, a leading member of the Al-Qaeda-linked network Jamaa Islamiya, was emotional as he testified at his trial that he'd been against the bombings from the beginning. He said he'd been afraid, however, to challenge more senior members of the group. "I still feel guilty," he said in a trembling voice. "I helped make some of the chemicals used in the explosives. Why didn't I inform the police? From the bottom of my heart, I apologize to the victims and their families." He faces a death penalty. Mitt Romney responded Thursday to a news article in the Washington Post describing him as a prep school prankster who bullied a classmate. He apologized for past incidents that may have been harmful, adding that he'd grown into a different person since his high school days. And he doesn't remember the incident anyway. So he hasn't grown into a more remembering person. Eastern Michigan University is apologizing after an email intended for 100 students with bad grades went out to many more, telling them they'd been kicked out of school. J.P. Morgan Chase issued a surprise trading update, admitting it had incurred $2 billion worth of trading losses the past 6 weeks. Jamie Dimon, chief executive of the bank, cited sloppiness, bad judgment, and many errors. He described the mistakes as egregious. So let's let them run the world, shouldn't we? Kind of an apology. And Vice President Joe Biden apologized to President Barack Obama for upsetting the White House's timetable for revealing the president's support for same-sex marriage, according to an administration official. Biden delivered the apology to the president the morning before Obama gave an interview to an ABC News anchor who the White House selected to do the interview. Cute. Very cute. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
different way to choose a vice presidential candidate.
And reality TV takes a big step towards reality.
Got to be Inside Extra Access tonight for early May 2012.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm recovering TV personality Pat Mungo.
Somebody once said the vice presidency of the United States wasn't worth a warm bucket of spit. But in today's digital age, it may really be worth that. And more.
But while this year's Republican presidential primary contest was smack dab in the middle of 21st century cable and internet America, the vice presidential selection process has remained shrouded in secrecy and tradition.
Until now, veteran reality TV producer Jason Schieskopf is about to change all that. And fast.
And soon.
And more.
I was sitting in the editing room one night. We were just shaping the villain thread for America's Next Top Hairstylist. And one of the editors was saying, hey, you know what's crazy? We vote on everything these days, except who's going to be running for vice president. And I thought, you know, he may be an editor, but he's just given me a great idea. And that's what's led me to create America's Got Veep, and to own it, too, no matter what some editor's lawyer might say.
Jason's idea was to utilize the political dead months before the national convention to create a competition show, pitting likely vice presidential candidates against each other.
And in the grand tradition of such shows, viewers get to eliminate a candidate each week.
So this year, it's the Republicans. I mean, you know, we're still assuming Biden is on the other ticket, okay? So, right, we got Rob Portman, Chris Christie, Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio, and then some, you know, some left field choices, I guess I should say right field. We've invited Rush Limbaugh and Michelle Malkin for some double X chromosome appeal. And each week it's a competition inspired by one of the classic competition shows. So one week it's something involving running with a canoe, a la Survivor. The next week it's diving into a pool full of maggots, a la Fear Factor. So it's some maybe unfamiliar faces, but they're pitted against each other in what we now recognize as familiar kinds of battles.
Jason asked me to come aboard to do week four, which is when the candidates have to put together their own TV debate look in just 2 hours.
Longtime Project Runway star Tim Gunn.
So it's about organizing your time. You've got maybe 15 minutes to select a suiting fabric, assuming you're going conventional, and then it's crazy time for the tailors. And while they're cutting and sewing, it's shirts and ties and shoes, maybe even a pocket square if they dare, putting it all together, and then it's crunch time when they do their walk to the debate podium and take their position. It's nervous time. At least we hope so. Otherwise, the music will seem weirdly inappropriate.
Of course, there won't be any debate. There's absolutely no politics in the show because I think America thinks it wants to get to know these people, not just as people, but as competitors. Somebody who wants to get much lower numbers can do the politics. And because the presidential candidate is Romney, week 7, which is right before the selection show, features a business challenge. Although we don't have a Donald Trump in a scary boardroom, the competitors will have a week to create 10 jobs, not counting household help. And T. Boone Pickens will be there to judge them harshly.
Well, the price of natural gas has plummeted in the past year, so I got to do something to make me get out of the house.
Of course, politicians are always trying to prove they're just like real people. So, week 3, they hang out with Snooki from Jersey Shore.
We go to the high-end mall. We go to the scuzzy mall. We go back to the high-end mall. They got my nails fixed. And you get to decide who rolls with Snooki like Snooki rolls.
Of course, the selection between the final two contestants is up to Mitt Romney.
And Jason Schieskopf has a commitment from him to participate if the show finds a network.
He said in a conversation with our people that that might help avoid the Palin problem, is what he said. Then he said he was joking. So, but no, we got 3-4 networks nibbling at this thing. Obviously, time is of the quintessence. So we're looking for an answer by late next week. Then we pull the trigger, go, 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 live for 8 weeks. If this doesn't make America more interested in who's on the ticket, I'll dive into maggots. Not really.
We'll keep on top of America's Got Veep, so stay tuned for more.
And more.
That's got to wrap it for now.
But Inside Extra Access Tonight comes rolling back tomorrow with an exclusive interview with the stars of the first same-sex marriage breakup movie, The Gay Divorcee.
And we'll have the results of our latest IEAT poll. We asked you which TV shows you'd pick up for next fall. And the results will have you reaching for the remote or the Ativan.
Till then, I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. So long from Culver City.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Unwanted guests in the form of poisonous caterpillars could be making their way to London just in time for the Olympic Games. Authorities reportedly setting up, well, you know about that, missile launchers. Nature's own threat to the Games may be lurking in oak trees. The larval form of the oak processionary moth can cause vomiting and dizziness if their hairs are inhaled, potentially bringing misery to millions of spectators, says the Telegraph. The caterpillar contains 63,000 toxic hairs, which can also lead to asthma attacks, skin and throat rashes, and watery eyes. The caterpillar first appeared in Britain 6 years ago after they came over on oak trees imported from Holland and then rapidly spread across the region. Officials have destroyed upward of 700 nests. They fear the pests may be on the rise due to an unreasonably warm winter. A third of City of London firms have made no contingency plans for the Olympics, and only 1 in 10 are planning to allow staff to work from home. Research by the MWB Business Exchange of 430 London companies in potential travel hotspots find they are underprepared for the Games in ways that cost the British economy billions of dollars. Not counting the $13 billion they're paying to put on the Games to begin with. A London-wide Olympic stress test of businesses in readiness for the Games started this week. 80 days before the opening ceremony, MWB says this is too little, too late. Olympic organizers have been urging employers to allow staff to be flexible, but so far, not. Our survey shows, says the spokesperson, that many London businesses are sleepwalking into a potential work nightmare. Businesses who have not really thought about it are really going to be hit the hardest. During Snow Day, February 3 years ago, £1 billion was lost in the economy. Now times that by 17 days of the Olympics, and you can see the potential hit the UK economy could take. Spectators will be banned from taking bottles of water into the Olympic Park in case they are used to conceal so-called liquid bombs. Airport-style security means all liquids in containers of 100 milliliters or more, Tom?
Milliliters?
Thank you. Will be confiscated, leaving visitors to buy drinks at inflated prices once inside. Picnics and excessive amounts of food will also be confiscated. And the Ministry of Defense has confirmed a sonic device will be deployed in London during the Olympics. The American-made long-range acoustic device, the LRAD, can be used to send verbal warnings over a long distance or emit a beam of pain-inducing tones. Or they could just play loud hip-hop. A spokesman for the manufacturer denies it's a weapon. The Ministry of Defense said it would be used primarily in the loud hailer mode. Better than a bullhorn. You there, move, or we'll emit painful noise. News of the Olympics. It's a movement, and we all need one. Every day! produced by Jim Eversole Jr. And now, news of the Adam.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, safe, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addy, you enjoying your time in Santa Monica? Addy the Adam?
Yeah, went in the ocean.
You went in the ocean?
Yeah, and I tried to blow by myself.
Yeah, what happened?
Burned my proton.
You burned your proton. Federal officials investigating excessive tube wear, that excessive tube wear at San Onofre down the coast, which caused a small radiation leak, nothing to worry about, cannot produce documentation of a presentation by the operator of the plant that focused on the level of federal scrutiny required for design changes at the plant. A nuclear expert requested that public document from the NRC, but as of Friday, almost a month after the NRC responded it would request a copy from Edison, there had been no word that the company provided. The presentation was supposed to be included in the official records of a public meeting billed as an introduction and a high-level overview by Edison of its plans to replace the steam generators at San Onofre. Part of the presentation's purpose was to show why the design changes could be approved through a process that did not involve a thorough analysis by regulators at the NRC. Now, of course, the tubes are rubbing. Dateline New Hill, North Carolina, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission said it's conducting a special inspection at the Sheeran-Harris nuclear power plant to determine why the plant's two main steam isolation valves failed last month. The plant, owned by Progress Energy, located about 20 miles southwest of Raleigh, North Carolina, had shut down, was in the process of cooling for refueling. See what I did there? When two main steam isolation valves failed to close. Following additional operator actions, one of the valves closed a little more than half an hour later. The second took 3 hours to close. They play an important role in limiting the release of steam in a nuclear plant during certain accident scenarios, according to the NRC. There were no safety implications during the April 21st event.
Of course not. Never are.
But there was a potential safety risk had an accident occurred while the valves were stuck open.
If.
Dateline Aiken, South Carolina, a recent report released by the NRC, expressed concern that the saltstone disposal facility at the Savannah River site may not meet the standards to prevent radiation exposure to the site's surrounding population in the long term. A technical evaluation report found that while waste disposal meets the requirements for protection of individuals against inadvertent intrusion through groundwater, for example, the NRC is not convinced that the radiation exposure dosage to the general population would be below the required dose 10,000 years from now.
You're not going to be here.
You will.
That's right.
Based on its evaluation of DOE's results and independent sensitivity analyses, the NRC staff no longer has reasonable assurances that the Department of Energy's disposal activities at the plant meet the performance objective for protection of the general population from releases of radioactivity over 10,000 years, ladies and gentlemen. Because we're so good at long-range thinking. Dateline Washington, the federal government has done an adequate job of maintaining oversight over a key funding mechanism designed to help keep nuclear power plants safe after they shut down, says the General Accountability Office. GAO said owners of reactors have been required to maintain a fund for shutting down plants based on a formula the NRC devised. The GAO identified several weaknesses in current practices. The formula may not reliably estimate decommissioning costs, for example. The consortium building two new nuclear power units in Georgia has told Southern Company that it will have to pay an additional $400 million to finish the units on time. Southern Georgia Power Unit owns 45% of the reactors. The cost overruns would mean that a total of $900 million would be added to the $14 billion cost of the new reactors. For that money, you could have had the Olympics. But in its quarterly filing with the SEC, Southern says it has not agreed with the amount of these proposed adjustments. Of course, the Public Service Commission at the state has allowed the company to charge its customers $1.7 billion of the company's $6 billion in costs before the plants even start up. Dateline Limerick, Pennsylvania.
There once was a Limerick plant.
Stop. When radioactive water burbled through a manhole cover at the Limerick nuclear plant in March and flowed into Possum Hollow Creek and the Schuylkill River. It was not the first time it had happened. It was the fourth, or at least the fourth time it was documented. Further, none of the documents at Exelon Nuclear's Limerick station, examined by inspectors, found evidence the company had taken measures to prevent or detect future spills from the same secluded grate. This was despite the fact the company had concluded that at least one 2008 spill led to elevated levels of radioactive tritium in a sample taken from a nearby well. This was caused by the discharge pipe into the river becoming sufficiently blocked with debris and river silt from the river, which caused the water pressure to build up and release the irradiated water through the vent. At least 15,000 gallons of water laced with radioactive tritium overflowed briefly, formed puddles in the area, and was discharged into the river, from which people get their drinking water, don't you know? And according to a manager at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Region 4 office in Arlington, Texas, is accused of blocking safety concerns from staff at the Fort Calhoun nuclear plant and intimidating inspectors who raise those concerns, according to the Wall Street Journal. I guess because they like people to know nothing's wrong. New, clean, safe, cheap, too much fun to meter. Our friend the Atom. Eddie, go dry off.
Will do.
Than to run through a ring of fire. I should have known better than to shoot with a gun for hire. Should have known better to repeat everything I see. Should have known better, but now it don't mean a thing. Deep down inside. I should have known better than to sit back and watch it burn. Should have known better than to stick to the rules I've learned. Rules I've learned. Should have known better than to stare down a voodoo queen. I should have known better, but now I don't mean a damn thing deep down inside.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world via the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin. How's that Euro thing working out for you? Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. And available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it'd be just like cities being able to make promises and keep them if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. A typical of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Join the more than 62,000 followers. They're really leaders. At The Harry Shearer. They're either followers, leaders, or get out of the wayers. I can't tell. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the rubber promise.